Public Radio News. It's now 9:06.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and here are some of the voices from this week's top news stories.
We are funding improvements to our roads and bridges and the completion of I-93. And we reached across the aisle and created a balanced, fiscally responsible budget without a sales or an income tax.
As most of you know, I've lived here in the state as a resident for the last 15 years. And in that 15 years, I've voted in New Hampshire and only in New Hampshire. And I'm a proud, proud resident of this great state.
In New Hampshire, we deeply value free speech and the right to privacy, and this law is narrowly tailored to enable the protection of both these fundamental rights.
Well, overall, we're doing pretty well here, and 98% of New Hampshire veterans are able to see a doctor in Manchester within 30 days, and that's better than a national average of 96%.
When we travel with the governor, whether it was with Steve Merrill years ago or Governor Hassan, we're allowed to get in the room with critical decision makers in these countries that we ordinarily wouldn't get into.
From the top, that was Democratic Governor Maggie Hassan filing for re-election for a second term, Republican Walt Havenstein addressing his supporters during his filing for governor, Jennifer Frizzell of Planned Parenthood commenting on the signing into law of a 25-foot buffer zone for protesters around abortion clinics, NHPR's Brian Walston reporting on access to health care for New Hampshire veterans and how it compares nationally, and businessman Tom Blay on his participation in an upcoming state trade mission to Turkey. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you as we examine these and other stories. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. Our guests for this week's Roundup are Kevin Landrigan, longtime political reporter for The Telegraph of Nashua. Kevin, thanks for giving us your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University and author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Dean, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
And also with us, Rick Stevens, Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press. And Rick, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, Rick, I want to start with you. The Department of Veterans Affairs scandal about health care and the resulting national review of VA health care hit home in New Hampshire this week. Just step back for us, if you could, Rick. Remind us where this big national report comes from, why we're looking at this.
This emerged a few months ago in Phoenix, Arizona, where the VA hospital there was found to have some 1,700 veterans who were at risk of just not getting any care at all. They had fallen off the radar, so to speak. Of course, there was a great outcry in Washington and around the country, and the VA itself launched an audit of all 731 of its sites in the nation. They took some 2 weeks during the month of May, and they visited these sites to check what their waiting lists were, how long patients had to wait to see a primary care physician, a specialist, a mental health provider, et cetera. Now, New Hampshire did fare pretty well. As the reporter said, 98% of its patients were seeing a physician within 30 days of getting an appointment, or of seeking an appointment, I should say. But there are still some 100 veterans on the list that aren't getting appointments 90 days out. So if they ask for an appointment, it's 90 days before they can even be scheduled to see a doctor. Now, the VA is taking steps to try and address this. They have contacted 50,000 veterans across the country to get them off those waiting lists. They talk about more funding, some $300 million over the next 3 months to get the medical care, to get it ramped up to take care of these veterans that are still waiting to see doctors.
So veterans care in New Hampshire, Rick, and correct me if I'm wrong, is a little different than in many other states, right? Because most states have a standalone VA hospital. We've got a center, but it's not a full-fledged hospital. Is
that
right?
That's right. It's the VA Medical Center in Manchester. They see some, I think there were 20,000 veterans on appointment lists as of this May 15th audit.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah, sure. There are also some, they call them CBOCs, community-based outpatient clinics, and there are throughout the state. Now, those sites were also audited. I should say many of them were audited, not all, and none of them required a further up, a follow-up review, rather.
Yeah, Kevin, what do you pull out of this whole national review and then also the focus in on New Hampshire that we've seen this week?
Yeah, this sort of, for politicians, this really is the perfect storm. I mean, you have a scandal that essentially comes out at the dawn of an election year and a midterm election in which both parties, there's hyper-partisanship in the air. This led to certainly the departure, the forced resignation of Eric Shinseki, the VA commissioner. And I think so it's one of the reasons why Congress this week kind of swung into action. It's pretty unusual to get both parties of Congress to do much of anything these days. But both parties recognize we got to look like we're doing something. They passed some legislation pretty quickly. It looks like it could well be conferenced and agreed to by the end of this month, as Rick said, to increase funding to there is a New Hampshire component to this legislation as well. In the Senate, both Senators Kelly Ayotte and Gene Shaheen got together, worked on some language essentially would help New Hampshire since it's the only state without its own VA hospital, as you point out, Laura. It would essentially say that in such a state, all the patients would be able to see private doctors if they're unable to see the VA hospital, as long as they have to travel more than 20 miles to a VA hospital. So there's a VA hospital in White River Junction, Vermont. So this wouldn't really help a lot of the people in the western part of the state in the Claremont Upper Valley area. They wouldn't come under this. But a great majority of veterans, if this provision were to become law, would be able to see a doctor, a private doctor with VA support, rather than have to go to a hospital.
So a voucher to see a private doctor. So you don't have to travel all the way to Vermont or Manchester. For some people in New Hampshire, that's a long way.
Yes, it is. And many travel to Boston as well, particularly to get specialty care. Veterans often go to Boston if their medical case is complicated.
The politics of this, Dean, Kevin touched on it, but I'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, absolutely. It is one of the core issues that all politicians have to deal with during an election year. So the timing couldn't have been worse, particularly for Democrats, although this is a problem that has this has been a problem for Republican presidents as well, going back many decades. You know, we've clearly learned that this is a systemic problem, the way that they dealt with scheduling and appointments. But, you know, looking at the data and listening to a lot of the anecdotal evidence, New Hampshire veterans, and this would include people treated up at White River Junction's facility, seem to be doing a little bit better, at least in terms of primary care. I think the figure I saw was 98% of patients are seen within 30 days, and the average wait for a primary care appointment is a little over 2 weeks. I think the target is 2 weeks. So, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's not too bad. But there are sort of variations in waiting time depending on whether you're talking about mental health or women's care or primary care, et cetera. So politically, it's a very important issue for politicians. We've seen a number of these legislative solutions proposed. You know, now that General Shinseki has resigned, they have to move on and come up with a solution.
Well, speaking of politics, Dean, in just a minute, I want to ask you and Rick and Kevin about all the political filings this week at the Secretary of State's office. But let me also remind you that you can join us with your questions and comments. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in the Exchange. We're covering some of the top stories of the week, including this veterans health care situation in New Hampshire and the report that came out. Let's hear from you on that story and many others. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Dean, to you first, the candidate filing period closes today. We could see a couple people rushing in at the last minute, paper and check in hand. What a week, including some surprises. Let's do the federal races first,
sure.
Dean. What did we see in that big marquee U.S. Senate race this week?
Sure. Just kind of a general overview first. I mean, we really are talking about Republican primaries here. You look at the statewide offices, governor, House of Representatives, U.S. Senate, all Democratic incumbents. So the question was going into this, would the Republican Party in the state be able to field competitive primaries? I know we've seen there is a fairly healthy list of individuals who have filed for all of those races. You know, the big ticket one obviously is Senator Shaheen, who filed to run for reelection. And as we know, she's being challenged by Scott Brown and Bob Smith. And Jim Rubens and Karen Testerman. So you know, she filed. I think for her the challenge is going to be talking about Obamacare in a way that kind of shows that she supports the core concept, but that understands there needs to be some movement for reform. This figure that I'd like to explore a little bit more that says that, you know, she voted with President Obama 99% of the time. Different outfits kind of count and catalog, you know, how your voting record compares to the president's agenda. So I hear this figure time and again from the Republican candidates that she's voted with Obama 99% of the time. And if his popularity is declining, in theory, that should sort of spill over to her. So I want to see how she deals with that as well. But yeah, we're really looking at a set of four competitive Republican primaries for that September 9th date.
And again, Scott Brown, Jim Rubens filed last week. Karen Testerman and Bob Smith, Rick, have yet to file. So two more people who have yet to jump in.
That's right. And the deadline is for those offices is, of course, today. So they still have time to do that. I believe Bob Smith may be scheduled for 11 a.m. today over at the Secretary of State's office. To go back to the Shaheen Brown for a moment, it's interesting that Scott Brown continues to push on Obamacare. He has his Obamacare Isn't Working tour, and it shows up an awful lot in his literature and on the campaign trail. Other Republicans nationally have sort of started to back away from that as an issue, as they seem to see, you know, higher enrollment numbers, a little bit more acceptance in the polls of the Affordable Care Act. And on the other side, Jean Shaheen has said she still believes in it, while some other Democrats have also sort of backed away. So these two candidates may be an outlier on that one.
Well, and very quickly, Kevin Landrigan, in the 2nd Congressional District, the incumbent has filed, Anne McClain Custer, two Republicans are in, Marilinda Garcia and Gary Lambert, and there's a new candidate this week.
That's right, Lord. Jim Lawrence, a former state legislature from Hudson, a three-term legislator, filed for office. He's the first African-American to run for federal office in New Hampshire, which is certainly a milestone. Filed with another first-time African-American candidate, Eddie Edwards, filed for a state Senate seat, first one from first African-American to run for the Senate.
All right. Well, coming up, we'll talk about the Republican race for governor. There's a new candidate jumping in. To find out who he is, though, you got to stay with us. For more Friday New Hampshire News Roundup and The Exchange coming up, keep it right here.
And this is The Exchange on NHPR. It's 919. Good morning. I'm David Darman. The Exchange is coming to the North Country. Join Laura Kanoy and a panel of experts as they discuss the state of the Main Street economies north of the Notches. You can attend this special event at the Colonial Theater in Bethlehem on July 10th. Reserve your tickets at nhpr.org. And support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank. Customized business banking for businesses, professionals, municipalities, and not-for-profit organizations. CentrixBank.com. Birchill Terrace, a not-for-profit continuing care retirement community offering independent living, assisted living, and nursing care in Manchester. BirchillTerrace.com. And New Hampshire Business Review, for more than 35 years, a Granite State source for business news, analysis, and commentary, with breaking business news at NHBR.com.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we're covering some of the stories that made headlines this week, including a major national report about veterans' health care around the country and in New Hampshire. Give us a call if you have questions about that. We've also been looking at the closing of the filing period, which ends today, at which point we'll know who all the candidates are running for office here in the Granite State this fall. You can join us with your questions and comments on these and other stories of the week at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Kevin Landrigan, Dean Spiliotis, Rick Stevens, just a couple more wrap-up questions for you about this filing period. In the 1st District, Dean Spiliotis, Dan Innes filed. He's a Republican running for 1st District against the incumbent, Carol Shea Porter. But first, he has to get through primary with Frank Ginta.
That's right. And Frank Ginta obviously is running to get his seat back from Carol Shea Porter. They've traded places in recent years. And Dan Innes, as we know, was a dean at UNH. He's gay, he's married, and Republican, which is sort of a new spin for Republican candidates in the state. sort of fiscally conservative has been his message. You know, he's been fairly active. I think in general we're going to see all of these campaigns start to ramp up over the summer. But yeah, so he's in officially. So Frank Gintis is going to have a little competition.
Well, and by the way, we've got a link to the Secretary of State's list of who's filed so far in both parties. It's on our website and on our Facebook page. And I was looking at it this morning. It's kind of fun to look at all the names. These things run dozens and dozens of pages, as Kevin Landrigan knows. So check it out. The list is on our website, nhpr.org, and on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. So all of you, as we talk about these congressional candidates, Rick Stevens to you first, how are some of them talking about the big upset in Virginia this week with the stunning defeat of Eric Cantor, number two in the House, to Tea Party candidate David Bratt? How are they folding this into their own campaign narratives here in New Hampshire?
Well, first of all, Laura, I've got to say it's not some of them. It's all of them.
Really? And
boy, it was a really funny exercise to watch within minutes of Cantor's defeat becoming public. All sides decided to claim victory somehow. Just a quick sampling, Dan Innes said it was going to be bad for Frank Ginter. Democrats said it was bad news for the Republican ticket, Scott Brown, Walter Havenstein. Havenstein said it was bad for incumbents. Brown said it was bad for Sheen. Everybody came out of the woodwork. It was really kind of astonishing. And I think two lessons here are learned. One is that political spin knows no bounds. And second, it's really hard to paint a broad brush based on just one race in Virginia, in the Virginia 7th. But it was very interesting to see the reaction to that.
Yeah, Gary Lambert had a lot to say, that this was good for conservative Tea Party candidates, and he was the guy, and he was going to be just like this Professor Bratt in Virginia.
He did.
Dean?
Oh, it's interesting, because Marilinda Garcia, someone who also has claimed to have Tea Party backing in that same primary. Yeah, the Frank Ginta case is interesting, because when Frank Ginta first won that congressional seat, I remember seeing him on cable news with the phrase and quote, it's underneath Tea Party freshmen. But this time he has sort of reinvented himself as a little bit more bipartisan. So I'm interested to see if in the wake of this Cantor defeat, if he starts to kind of back away from that approach a little bit. You know, for me, this whole Cantor issue is really a continuation of an intra-party battle in the Republican Party that's been raging for at least since John McCain ran for president in 2000. So it's over a decade now. I think we're going to see some pushback from the quote establishment. They're talking about making Kevin McCarthy, the Republican whip, the new majority leader. He's even more moderate than Cantor on things like immigration because he's from a California district with a Hispanic population. So that's not going to solve the problem within the party. I think it's just going to kind of raise the stakes a little bit. So I'm not surprised to see, as Rick said, everybody trying to get a little bit of political capital out of this event.
Well, and I'm sure on the Friday News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show, they'll be dissecting this more. But it is interesting that it's had repercussions here in New Hampshire. Kevin, did you want to quickly step
in?
Yeah,
just what's the biggest problem the Republican Party has nationally after the spanking they took in 2012, it's appealing to minority voters. And that's what's fascinating about what's happening here in the filing period here in New Hampshire. We've got the first African-American candidate running for Congress in state history.
On the Republican side,
we have an avowed gay candidate for Congress, Dan Innes. On the Republican side, we've got a Hispanic young woman, Marilinda Garcia, seeking to be the first Hispanic elected to federal office on the Republican side. I don't think it's by accident. I do believe every decision made by candidates, all kind of individual judgments are made before they actually file. But I think all of this is a reflection of a lot of minorities out there essentially saying, you know, if I run for a major office, I could get some significant establishment support in the Republican Party. And we're certainly seeing that with Marilinda Garcia. A lot of Hispanic leaders nationally are extremely excited about her candidacy, and many Republican heavyweights in Washington have pledged to support her financially as
well,
a result.
As we talk about firsts too, Kevin, and we can't talk about the entire state Senate race here on the News Roundup, but an African-American candidate is filing for one of the state Senate districts, too.
Right. Eddie Edwards, former state liquor commission enforcement chief, sort of head of the police force there, also a retired police chief. He's got an even tougher road to head, frankly, than Marilinda Garcia does running in a state Senate district. It's one of the two or three most Democratic. David Waters from Dover is the current incumbent. It's going to be really difficult for him to run, but state Republicans were really excited about him getting into this race, and we'll feature him a great deal this fall.
Well, and Kevin, very quickly, I did promise to tell folks about the new candidate who filed for governor this week. Now, Walt Havenstein has filed. He's the Republican, considered the establishment candidate. Governor Hassan filed for re-election this week, and then there's someone new jumping in.
Yeah, Jonathan Smolin, an Alton activist. He's been somewhat active in the Republican Liberty Caucus, a very conservative group here. His candidacy is often what we see in New Hampshire. That's what's unique about New Hampshire, and there are many things politically that are unique, is how easy it is to run here. I mean, we haven't changed our filing fees in more than 50 years. It only costs $100 to run for governor, $2 to run for state representative.
$2?
$10 to run for a state senate.
You can barely get a cup of coffee for $2.
Exactly. So as a result, every 2 years, we see little-known candidates, often with a single message, kind of come out of the woodwork and decide to run. It's why we've got at least 10 candidates running for the U.S. Senate on the Republican side this time.
Again, if you want to look at the list of all the names who are running, it's on our website, on our Facebook page, NHPR.org and NHPR Exchange, all one word. It's interesting to look at all the many, many names. Go ahead, Rick Stevens, you want to jump in too.
You speak of the list. I spoke with Secretary of State Bill Gardner yesterday. 2 years ago, they had 1,510 names on that list of candidates. It was a record then. As of yesterday, they were on pace to go beyond that this
really?
Year.
Really? Even so in an off-presidential year?
Even in an off-year.
Well, and we get in the presidential primary, you typically get between 25 and 30 candidates in each party, even though we're really only talking about a handful of serious contenders.
We talked about the Tea Party earlier, and Rick Stevens, a Tea Party candidate, if I can call him that, Andrew Hemingway, is also running for governor on the Republican side. He filed last week.
He filed yesterday.
Yesterday
was his filing. He's certainly a more conservative candidate. A young entrepreneur from Bristol, I believe, 31 years old. So we'll see what happens in that Republican primary.
Dean?
Well, and we should also mention Walt Havenstein, who filed for governor. He's been dogged by this residency issue, and he actually launched a bit of a preemptive strike. He filed his own petition with the Ballot Law Commission to see whether he's eligible or not to be on the ballot, rather than wait for either Andrew Hemingway or the Democratic Party to file that. So we'll see. The issue is, you know, he owned this condo in Maryland while he was CEO of a firm down there, claimed he was domiciled and voted in New Hampshire, but took a tax break on the condo for Maryland residents. So, the ballot commission will rule on the legality of him running for governor, but I don't think as a political issue it's necessarily going to go away.
All right. Well, here's an email that just came in from Christopher in Manchester, picking up on something you said, Kevin. Christopher says, while the Democratic Party always claims to be the party of, quote, diversity and, quote, inclusion, I think it's important to note that Innes and Lawrence are both firsts and both Republicans. So again, just following up on the point you made there. Christopher, thank you for the email. The email address for you to join us is exchange@nhpr.org. You can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org, as I said, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Rick Stevens, Medicaid expansion is coming under the Affordable Care Act. The state began information sessions this week. Remind us, Rick, how this fits into the overall story of the ACA.
Well, under the ACA, of course, health care was expanded to those who didn't have insurance, but that still left a pool of some 50,000 people without insurance. These are people living at 138% of the poverty line or below.
So who make a little too much money to qualify for Medicaid under current rules.
Exactly. So what they did, and there was a lot of, and Kevin can certainly speak to the political wrangling that went on between the houses and the parties, but they did come together this summer to expand Medicaid to 50,000 people. The informational sessions are going to be really important. This is a confusing issue. It's been as confusing as a lot of things have been with the ACA. So the state wants to get out in front and really let people know what's happening. Basically, what some deadlines coming up, some 38,000 people will start to get care as of July 1st if they do certain things. The state also still needs a waiver, I believe, Kevin, from the federal government for that to happen. And there's still a lot of question marks about this. There was some resistance among people that say, hey, when the federal government stops funding this thing in 3 years, we're going to end up on the hook for it. So the legislature, I believe, gave themselves an out by saying, we'll only go past 3 years if we reauthorize the Medicaid expansion.
Now, the funding is 100% for the first 3 years, but then it's 90% after that. So it's not like they're just going to completely pull out all the money.
That's right.
But the fear is they might, and I think the lawmakers have given themselves an out. Is that right, Rick? Yeah, Kevin?
Yes, they have. It's actually the legislature is going to have to reauthorize this in 3 years, or the program simply goes away. It was the Senate Republicans insisted on that being a provision here because, as Rick said, New Hampshire has some costs in this program to begin with. It is 100%. The benefit payments are 100%, but there are going to be some administrative costs to process all these people through this program. Governor Hassan also said earlier this week that it's quite possible we're not going to meet the July 1st starting date. As Rick said, we're still waiting for federal waivers. We need to have those for this to occur. It's also important to note that while the whole goal of this and the reason why Republicans in the Senate went along is to provide private insurance for these folks who are under expanded Medicaid eligibility, that's not going to happen for at least a year. So as a result, these 38,000 this summer are essentially going to go into the traditional Medicaid program under managed care.
Because not enough stuff is ready yet.
Exactly. Two things. One, we don't have the federal approvals to allow them to have private insurance. And two, the state insurance department hasn't even found out, hey, how many companies out there want to provide coverage to these folks? There'd have to be a new enrollment program for these private insurers to cover them, and that's going to take some time.
All right. And on Monday in the exchange, I want to let everybody know we're going to be doing a whole, what we're calling a checkup of the ACA, how it's been rolling out here in New Hampshire. So we'll definitely dig into that more. But very quickly to you, Dean, one of the things we're going to talk about on Monday, but I'd love to hear from you now, is just how this Affordable Care Act is going to be talked about in this fall's elections here in the Granite State. You know, Rick and Kevin touched on it earlier, but I'd love to get your thoughts on how big a deal this is. Will other things be bigger?
It depends. I mean, we'll see where the economy is in the fall, but I think this will be, you know, healthcare. If you look at polling data, it's traditionally one of the top issues behind the economy generally and then jobs specifically. So it's always an important issue. I would say, you know, Republicans have kind of backed away a little bit from the let's repeal it argument, but they you know, some say they still want to repeal it, but there's still a lot of talk about, keeping some of the things that are popular, like keeping your children on your insurance and the pre-existing conditions, et cetera. But I think it's going to be a continued issue. And Rick mentioned Scott Brown. He's put a lot of eggs in that basket already. I'm not really sure what else he will run on other than kind of general arguments about federal spending and the size of government. So it's going to continue to be a big issue. The enrollments seem to be working better. More people seem to be engaging the program. Yet you look at public opinion data, and as a political issue, it's still quite unpopular. So I think there is, quote, sort of an optics or an image issue for this program, even if the reality of the numbers is somewhat different. So I expect to hear a lot about it, even here in New Hampshire, from Scott Brown, if he turns out to be the nominee.
And some of the candidates for Congress as well?
Absolutely. Mary Linda Garcia is a good example. She really built the beginnings of her campaign on a critique of Obamacare. So sure, absolutely.
Our phone number again on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Join us on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're covering some of the top stories that made headlines this week in the Granite State. We've been talking about Medicaid expansion, if you have questions about that. Also, the recent review of veterans' health care nationally and here in New Hampshire, or some of the many candidates who made their way to the Secretary of State's office this week to file for the elections this fall. Join us with your questions and comments on these stories and more. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Kevin Landrigan, Governor Maggie Hassan signed a controversial law this week establishing a 25-foot buffer zone around abortion clinics. A similar Massachusetts law is before the U.S. Supreme Court, which is yet to decide. So this idea of buffer zones around abortion clinics is still in play. What were some of the key issues that came up during debate on this bill, Kevin?
Yeah, essentially the debate really revolved around whether folks who support these abortion clinics, there have been a number of complaints, particularly at the Penacook Street Clinic that Planned Parenthood operates in Manchester. There are weekly protests there and many complaints about clients being harassed as they come in or they leave. Opponents argue that this essentially is a violation of their First Amendment rights and has some pretty practical problems. If you have a 25-foot buffer zone around, say, the parking lot of some of these facilities, does that mean people can't linger on the sidewalk out there, even if they're not protesting? But it will be interesting to watch to see what the U.S. Supreme Court does. Some observers truly feel that there's a majority on the court to strike down this buffer zone in Massachusetts. And what was interesting was Governor Hassan decided affirmatively, I want this bill before I file. There's about almost 200 bills now in the legislative hopper. They've been passed by both bodies, but they still haven't got to her desk. And this is where the governor has some power to essentially say, I'm not ready to take this bill yet, but I want this bill now.
And it's a way to make a statement.
Right. And she decided to do this before she filed. She had a pretty big group yesterday when she filed, the supporters of women's health with signs, and it was a nice optic for her. And so she decided to do that. I guess my point is, politically, she could have well decided to have this bill held if she wanted to and have the Supreme Court rule, if they do, before the end of June. She's going on this trip to Turkey next week, so she'll be out of the state for that period of time and allow the Supreme Court to say something and then decide on this legislation, meaning sign this legislation but say, in light of the Supreme Court decision, here's what I think we should do to make the law constitutional going forward. But essentially she made the political call, I think the smart and easy political call. Let's get this bill and let's deal with whatever the Supreme Court does when they do it.
And since you mentioned the trip to Turkey, Kevin, I want to follow up with you on that very quickly. First, it was criticized for taking place after the governor imposed a travel freeze on state workers to save money. Then the union leader reported this week that the Turkish business group sponsoring this trip, paying for a big chunk of it, has ties to a controversial religious figure. What's going on here?
Yeah, interesting. Most governments often provide support for dignitaries to visit them. It's not unusual at all. The government of Taiwan was really one of the more infamous ones back in the 80s, beginning in the 80s and 90s. And this business group, as you say, has some controversial ties. Also, this imam, who's essentially advocated overthrow of the government before, is involved in this business group. They provided all kinds of support to legislators all over the country, not just in New Hampshire. And it certainly provides part of the criticism of this trip from Republicans in this race.
Okay. More after a short break. More Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Stay with us.
And this is The Exchange on NHPR. It's 9:39. Good morning. I'm David Darman.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, House Majority Leader Eric Cantor's surprising laws. Then the crisis in Iraq escalates as militants take over key cities, and the World Cup opens in Brazil. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning, beginning at 10 on NHPR. And support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Health South Rehabilitation Hospital in Concord, helping individuals return to active, independent lives through comprehensive medical rehabilitation services. HealthSouthConcord.com and Capital Center for the Arts in Concord, presenting Elvis Costello solo, performing songs that will reflect the breadth of his material, June 28th at 8 p.m. Tickets at CCANH.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, a checkup for the Affordable Care Act, how it's playing out here in the Granite State. That's Monday on The Exchange. Today, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and you can join us by calling 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Twitter at @NHPRExchange, or again, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, in just a moment, I want to ask you about a major story in Manchester this week, the Board of Aldermen overriding the city's spending cap. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But Rick Stevens, to you too, this trip to Turkey, as I said before the break, at first it was criticized because It is being undertaken at a time when state government is under a travel freeze. Now there's some connections to this imam who's advocated for the overthrow, I think you said, yes. Kevin Landergan, of the Turkish government. And it turns out this Turkish business group has funded, you know, travel around the country. I think there was a report in the Union Leader that said 10% of Iowa lawmakers have gone to Turkey thanks to this group. We won't untangle all this on the air, obviously, but what are the ramifications of this for Governor Hassan, if any?
Well, I think there will still be political ramifications right through November, no matter who takes the GOP nomination. At his filing yesterday, Andrew Hemingway, the conservative Republican hopeful, was asked about it, and he said this trip, quote, smells like baloney. Very blunt statement and sort of identified where he's headed on that. Hemingway thought that the governor ought to be spending her economic muscle looking in places much closer, Massachusetts and Vermont and New York and Canada, if we're talking about international trade. So I think this trip will continue to dog the governor through the election.
Dean, do you want to jump in on that?
Yeah, it is interesting. You know, whenever you have these kinds of trips in light of this group funding issue, this new story, I think is an interesting development. But generally, when you have a travel ban or a spending freeze and you have these kinds of stories, you know, you pretty much expect the opponents to talk about, paid vacation. And I think her daughter is going, although she's paying the daughter's way. So there were jokes about a vacation, or you typically use the word junket to describe these kinds of trips. I think Turkey is, I've read, was the 12th largest trading partner with New Hampshire. So, I mean, there is some economic interest here. You know, the trip is in a week, we'll see whether this turns to be a longer term issue. But I'm not surprised to hear opponents, you know, make hay of it. You know, my understanding was that I think the state government is kicking in $15,000, and $10,000 of that has already been spent. So they're partially making the argument that can't get that money back. We might as well go and do it and see if we can get an economic benefit out of it.
Well, anybody who's bought a plane ticket knows.
Yes.
They're in general hard to refund. Again, you can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. I want to ask all of you about a big vote in the city of Manchester this week where the Board of Aldermen voted to override the city's tax cap. I want to just quote a little bit from the Union Leader on this. The vote came at a special meeting Tuesday evening, the deadline for aldermen to complete a budget for the fiscal year that begins July 1st. The vote was 12-2. At least 10 votes were required to override the tax cap, which would have restricted the budget increase to 2.13%. Now, we're not going to get into all the numbers of the Manchester budget, obviously, but Kevin Landergan, why is this story important? Not just for Manchester, but for the whole state, because there are other places that have tax caps as well.
Yeah, there are. There are a number of communities that have tax caps or limitations on spending. And so Manchester's is probably the most aggressive, meaning the most conservative of the tax caps. Franklin has a pretty significant one as well. I think it's what's interesting about this story is essentially what's happening in communities across this state, which is to say that the economic recovery is not robust. Property tax values in the communities have not come back from the levels of 2008, 2009, when many communities lost 25-30% of its property value, which put a big crimp on local government. What you also have to know is that I think a number of communities now essentially are running out of rainy day or easy revenue options a few years after state government essentially started downshifting to communities.
Yeah, and that's a trend that's been going on for a long time.
It is, but it really ramped up in 2010 and 2011. We used to give out $50 million in revenue sharing. We don't give that anymore.
It's a lot of money.
The state used to support 35% of the health care costs for local retirees, all government employees. We don't support that at all. For the city of Manchester, for example, just those two things, that's over $6 million a year that they used to receive in that form of local aid. They no longer do.
So it's easy to have a tax cap, Kevin, when the state is giving you this nice chunky check every year. But once that goes away, it's harder.
Right. And it's also harder, as I said. And in when you're not in an economic malaise, certainly, but when you're not naturally growing your tax base. And that's what we see across the state.
Yeah, a couple other cities, as I said, that have these in place. Dean?
Yeah, I think in the Manchester case, I think that the budget under consideration increases by a little over 4% instead of this 2% cap. And I think Mayor Gatsas has said he wants it down under 4%. This is a perennial issue. There has been kind of a tax cap municipal movement in the state in recent years. City managers and city planners hate these things because it kind of structurally constrains them. And their argument is that, you know, the needs of a city vary from one year to the next. In Manchester and in some other cities, the issue is obviously crumbling infrastructure, you know, roads, drive around Concord or anywhere else. And you see that the roads need a lot of work. And in Manchester's case, been a lot of crime in the past year. So I guess to beef up policing as well.
Mel, and the schools have come under criticism as well, overcrowded classrooms and so forth. So, all right. Rick, do you have any thoughts on this Manchester tax cap story or what it means for other cities and towns that have it?
Sure. Dean touched on it. It's the age-old question of how do you provide services and at the same time keep your city affordable and livable. But Kevin, I think you mentioned the golden word, the pension and benefits. Those costs are growing across the country, and it's an uncontrolled growth right now that city managers and mayors and officials everywhere have to wrestle with and have to get under control.
And the state, again, isn't helping as much as it used to. It used to help a lot. All right. Well, I did want to turn to you, Dean, and ask you about a story that came out of Henniker, but again, has statewide, in fact, national implications. This concerns New England College and a slew of early retirements there. We've done a lot of coverage on this show about higher education, how it's under pressure to shift the way it does business. There was a major announcement along these lines at New England College this week. What changes are they making, Dean?
Yeah, this is very interesting and a little bit of a surprise to me, although, you know, folks who are associated with New England College may have been aware that this was in the offing. NEC has 68 full-time faculty members, and about 19 of those, or roughly 25%, are taking early retirement.
It is.
And so they get a few years' salary, and then they're going to be brought back as adjuncts to teach on a part-time basis. And, you know, this really is a symptom of big changes in education at the university level. I mean, I've been in it now for 20 years, and you see the shift towards the use of adjuncts and non-traditional faculty, part-time faculty. It's a way to basically control costs or reduce costs. It's also a way to deal with the shifting way in which people earn degrees, right? There's a big SNHU isn't the only school that has a big online presence now. You know, you got non-traditional students, people trying to finish in under 4 years. So the traditional model of, you know, a large full-time PhD tenured faculty is changing throughout much of the country. And I think for NEC to stay economically viable, this was a change they decided they need to make. But it was interesting to see it's 25% of the faculty.
Yeah, and again, this is something that's been happening for years and years.
It's been building slowly, but it is shifting increasingly towards a use of adjuncts and non-traditional faculty.
Yeah, usually it happens sort of post by post. This happened
right,
all at
once.
Right,
this was sort of a systemic decision.
Sure. Yeah. Go ahead, Rick.
Well, certainly this pressure on higher education is not unique to New Hampshire either. Just last month in Maine, the University of Southern Maine, their faculty senate identified positions they could cut to save some $5 million a year. It was either that or face layoffs of about a dozen faculty members as that college, Southern Maine, tries to shave 10% of its budget in a year. I think it was Vermont State Colleges last week had their credit rating downgraded. So there are financial pressures on higher education.
Enrollments are shrinking.
Financial aid
demands are up. I mean, it's a tough situation.
So at the college in Maine. What was it again, Rick, that you said, the name of it?
University of Southern Maine.
Yeah. So it sounds like some people there decided rather than have mass layoffs, we'll take, you know, a less attractive benefits package and working
and
hours.
And early
so
retirements.
Sure.
Yeah. In order to save this money, sure.
Kevin, let me give out the phone number, and then I do want to hear from you on this as well. The number, again, for you to join our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Kevin, I'd like your thoughts, too, on this New England College story. Again, it's a small college in, you know, Henniker, New Hampshire, but it's a big story.
Yeah, no, it certainly is. I think as well, I think what we're seeing, too, in higher education is really a re-engineering of the curriculum to meet what today's students are looking for. I mean, in New England College, you essentially had a pretty good model that worked for a long time, which is a small, mainly liberal arts institution
on campus
that that offered a very good education to their students. And at the end of the day, I think their enrollments have been dropping, and I think it's a reflection of no longer offering what students are looking for. Not enough courses on that campus, for example, in the STEM courses that so many students are, where the high-paying jobs exist today in science, technology,
it's
math.
It's an interesting shift that I've seen culturally where it used to be, and it still is for some schools, where, you know, give us your children and we will teach them what they need to know. And now students are being treated as consumers, right? And you got to fill the demand for whatever the particular consumer demand is at the time. And that is a shift that, you know, some places have taken to quite easily. Other places have really resisted it. But you are seeing this sort of cultural shift in how we view the role of university education really over the last 10, 20 years.
All right. Well, I have to ask all of you, Kevin, I think to you first, about a fun story that happened in Manchester last week. On Saturday, comedian Seth Meyers, a West High School graduate, 1992, came back to Manchester on Saturday. People were thrilled, thrilled. This is a big deal. Why was Seth Meyers in Manchester?
Yeah, it was an interesting performance he gave at the Palace Theatre, a benefit event. And he's obviously an international personality and someone who is very popular. And as a graduate of Manchester West High School, it's a very nice story.
Yeah, and a record-breaking fundraiser for the Palace, which an old theater always has expensive repairs and so forth. So it's great for them.
Right.
One piece of the story that I loved is he was asked to appear. He accepted no fee for his appearance, by the way, which is pretty classy. Asked to come or badgered to come by former Mayor Robert Baines, who was principal at West. He was Meyer's principal at West. So that was kind of fun, and I guess the former mayor got up there.
It is, too, in that Manchester West High School is certainly of all the high schools in Manchester, the most urban-based. It's in a very urban neighborhood. It's considered to be, therefore, probably the toughest place of the Manchester high schools. So Bob Baines was a very popular principal there and later became mayor. I think that's a neat story.
It's interesting, you know, Bedford and Manchester, a little bit of a hotbed of comedy. You have Seth Meyers, you've got Sarah Silverman, you've got Adam Sandler, a number of people who trace some portion of their childhood back to the area.
Something in the water down there makes people funny.
Yep. Second City East, right?
Second City.
Well, I did want to ask you, speaking of TV personalities, Dean Spiliotis, UNH is excited about its new Carsey School of Public Policy, funded by a $20 million grant from UNH alum and wildly successful TV producer Marcy Carsey. This week, Dean, the school got its founding director. This is a big deal for UNH.
Yeah, it is a big deal. You know, we've known about the Carsey Institute for a while, doing a lot of policy and social research. They're now, you know, upping the ante with this grant into a full-fledged public policy school. And so they're bringing in Michael Ettlinger, who to be the head of the Carsey School. He's coming to us from the Pew Charitable Trusts, where he was in charge of their fiscal and economic projects. And before that, he was a VP at the Center for American Progress, which is people typically think of as a slightly left-leaning think tank. But this is a big deal. He's obviously someone who will probably be helpful in terms of fundraising and sort of understanding how to set goals for the program. But, yeah, there's a lot of excitement in kind of taking the Carsey Institute mission to the next level with this full-fledged school.
And some people did say, hey, his background is at this left-leaning think tank. We're not sure about that. Is he going to do that at Carsey? And he said, no.
Well, and he did say that he believes that academics should be nonpartisan and kind of non-ideological. So, this is a debate that we have in universities all the time about the faculty being left-leaning. So, that's not an unusual thing to hear. But he seems to kind of understand what his mission is going to be at the head of the school. And we'll see where he takes it.
Well, I want to let everybody know a little bit of what we're up to next week on The Exchange and then find out what you guys are going to be tracking next week. Next week on The Exchange, we'll start off with a checkup for the Affordable Care Act. And as we've talked about just this morning, there's a lot happening in New Hampshire with this law around Medicaid expansion, which we covered. Also, new insurers coming on board on those marketplaces. Later on in the week, we're going to find out what invasive species to look out for this summer in the Granite State, both on land and in the water. So we'll educate your eyeballs in terms of what to look out for. I want to let everybody know, too, I've got some family obligations, so I'll be out for part of the week, but the show will be in the very capable hands of Brady Carlson and you, Dean Spiliotis. So thank you for that. Kevin Landrigan, what are you up to next week?
Yeah, it's sort of we're now that the filing period is closed, we're sort of in the fill-in-the-blanks mode. By next Wednesday afternoon, the chairman of both political parties, the Democratic and Republican chairman, get to essentially nominate some people to fill a spot that isn't taken. Now, as Rick pointed out, as we were talking about before, there's a whole lot of Republican primaries and a lot fewer Republican vacancies, but you'd be surprised how many there are. With a 400-member House, typically as many as 50 to 60 candidates in either party emerge this way. And many times, it's kind of interesting, many times these are folks who really wanted to run for this office, but they didn't want to run against an opponent. So they'll wait until the end of the filing period when it's official, and they'll say, yeah, you can put my name in now.
Okay, so if nobody jumps in for, you know, District XYZ,
right.
Then the heads of the parties are allowed to go out and say, you know, hey, Joe Smith, wouldn't you like to run for District XYZ?
Right, and that person doesn't actually file. The chairman of the party files that name for them.
And pays the $2.
Correct.
How about you, Rick Stevens? What are you following next week?
Well, we've got an interesting and fun look, a video look, at the new Mount Washington Observatory Museum.
Oh, I didn't know about
it's,
that.
It's supposed to bring the extreme weather of this very extreme mountain peak in the east, of course. And ironically, the ceremony is set for today had to be canceled because of extreme weather. I should say it was pushed to the bottom of the mountain. So
okay,
that'll be, take a look.
That's appropriate. Yeah. That's appropriate. Dean, how about you?
Well, you know, the filing period ends today. It's game on. I'll be interested. I'm going to start looking to see at the kind of the dynamic between the candidates within the primary. So far, it's been a lot of attacking of the incumbents. Now they're going to have to set their sights on each other because we're really only, you know, a little over 2 months, almost 3 months away from the primary.
Okay. Great stuff. Thank you very much, Dean, for being here and for filling in for me a little bit next week. Appreciate
it. Sure thing, Laura.
Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University. Rick Stevens, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Rick Stevens, Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press. Kevin, I know you're busy. Thanks for your time.
This is always fun, Laura.
Kevin Landrigan, longtime political reporter for The Telegraph of Nashua. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is David Darman. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Mikesell. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Renee Taylor. Theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we begin with a checkup for the Affordable Care Act, with new insurers coming in and new questions arising as New Hampshire begins to expand Medicaid. Then, what's behind a recent upsurge in violence in Iraq and why U.S. policymakers are so worried. And later, summer is boom time for invasive species. We'll ask what to look out for in the Granite State. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
This is NHPR. The Diane Rehm Show is coming up next. It's 9:59. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Nashua Crossings Assisted Living and Memory Care Community. Warm and inviting with services provided by caregivers who love what they do. Tour information at nashuacrossings.com. And Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank. Banking solutions customized to your business. Information available at centrixbank.com.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
And NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl arrived in the U.S. this morning after being freed by the Taliban 2 weeks ago. On Wednesday, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel faced tough questions over the prisoner exchange for Bergdahl. Hagel says it was an extraordinary situation.